Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Welcome to Swiss Political Roundup. This is Bob Zanotti, filling in for Peter Holler. In my letter from Switzerland back in October 2011, I talked about the changes in Swiss politics and society that I had been sensing. Well, that feeling was borne out in the general elections that followed a few days later, when there was a major shift in political polarization at the polls. And now in March 2012, another surprise has been recorded, as well as another indication that Swiss voters have become even more mature and discerning. They again demonstrated a desire for change, as well as a desire to liberate themselves from some of the political and economic ruts this country has been in for a long time. On March 11th, there were five federal issues to be decided by referendum. Three of them were especially important. The biggest issue, and also the biggest upset, was a proposition to limit the number of so-called second dwellings in Swiss communities. This was a people's initiative launched by the Swiss environmental protectionist warhorse, 85-year-old Franz Weber. The idea was to put a stop to uncontrolled construction and development of vacation dwellings, often belonging to non-resident foreigners, especially in resort areas. These second dwellings remain empty for most of the year. Not only were they seen as a threat to the natural landscape, but they also require costly infrastructure to support them. Nobody gave this initiative much of a chance of passage because of the large number of special interest groups that were against it, not least areas with a tourism-based economy. But at the end of the day, it was accepted by a small but sufficient margin, and so it must now be put into law. But because no one thought the initiative had a chance of passage, politicians and construction industry interests were caught napping, with nobody in government really sure how the law will be implemented in practice. Of course, some tourism and local political interests are up in arms over the success of the initiative, but voters were not sympathetic to them. The success of the Weber initiative can be explained by the Swiss love of nature and the fear that this country's natural beauty and recreational assets would be destroyed by continued uncontrolled building. Another factor was the left-wing resentment of big business interests, which they perceived as selling out the nation for the sake of an unscrupulous, quick profit. In either case, the brakes had to be applied, and now they will be. Another significant issue on the ballot was a proposed law which amounted to the establishment of a book price cartel all over the country. Until 2007, German-speaking Switzerland had done away with mandatory fixed prices for books, but Parliament passed a law to reintroduce book price fixing, largely because of pressure from the bookstore and kiosk lobby. Signatures were collected to put the issue to a referendum. And now the Swiss electorate has decided on a free, competitive approach to book pricing all over the country. One of the reasons for the success of the proposition was campaigns by consumer protection groups, which have repeatedly called attention to the substantially higher prices for books and other literature sold here, compared to prices in neighboring countries. They also drew attention to the fact that more and more literature is being sold via the Internet, including the new phenomenon of e-literature. The classic book-selling trade argued in favor of fixed book prices, claiming this would promote Swiss authors. But the electorate wasn't buying it. The third major issue on the March ballot was the one that made the news abroad. It was a people's initiative calling for 6 weeks of paid vacation for everyone, as compared to the 4 weeks most Swiss have now. 6 weeks, by the way, is the European norm. But here, the Swiss seemingly voted against their own personal interests and rejected the initiative by a wide margin. The antis, mainly from the employer's side, argued that more paid vacation would hurt Switzerland's productivity and competitiveness, especially in view of the current high value of the Swiss franc, which makes it harder to sell exports. Those of us with a more cynical view found this argument difficult to understand, given the fact that Swiss workers are already among the most productive in the world, and that the cost of treating illnesses associated with work-related stress is fixed at a whopping 10 billion francs a year, not to mention the lost productivity it also causes. But at the polls, Swiss voters decided that tranquilizers and antidepressants were better than 2 more weeks' holiday every year. The fact is that the Swiss get very worried over anything that might endanger job security. It's a very easy sell for employers, and they play that card for what it's worth. Add to that the fear that many Swiss, particularly in German Switzerland, have of their employers. In this area, change hasn't yet arrived.
As I'm speaking to you, part of me is in Italy, part of me is in Switzerland. We are on the world-famous, the renowned Great St. Bernard Pass, the place where they bred the Great St. Bernard dog. Yes, the monastery, the hospice is all here. You can hear in the background a mountain stream coming down, an occasional car passing by. Here's the stream. And this is the dividing line between two countries. We have sometimes great difficulty in fathoming, understanding these national frontiers of Europe. But that's the way it is. A mountain stream, it was decided, separates Switzerland from Italy. I'm still on the Italian side, and I'm in the European Union, a founding member of the European Union, Italy, and just literally inches away, my right hand actually is already in Switzerland. Isn't that something? Let me welcome back to the microphones of Switzerland in Sound, Aubrey Diem, professor of geography, and we might as well say what in effect he also was for many years in Ontario, Canada, a professor of history, a prolific writer, a political observer and novelist. Aubrey, nice to see you. You're on the Swiss side. I have to admit, just for the novelty of it, we had lunch on the Italian side. We decided to have a pasta dish. I had polenta, which is a traditional Italian dish from the mountains. And here we are. There it says, we look at the sign, it says Italia, benvenuti, Italia, European Union. And we turn around, and there is the Swiss customs, and it says, welcome to Switzerland, Col du Grand Saint Bernard, which is the French, the language on the Swiss side. It is French around here in Lower Canton Valley. And it says, altitude 2,473 meters. Well, I'm going to join you on the Swiss side.
Okay.
Here I am, Aubrey. The history of the Great St. Bernard Pass goes back to pre-Christian times, I understand.
Well, certainly the Celtics, who settled on both sides in the Rhone Valley and the Valley d'Aosta, had to come over this pass. It was just a footpath, naturally, but they came over, and probably many of them were caught up here, and there are no glaciers around, but it's an area that gets considerable snow, and in fact, the pass has just been open for a few weeks. It normally opens at the end of May, beginning of June.
Let me interject that this pass is one of the latest to open and one of the earliest to close.
Well, you see pictures, because at the hospice, you see pictures of what it's like in wintertime, and it's completely cut off from any kind of land transportation except skis. And there's enormous amounts of snows, 2-3 meters, depending upon the year. that closes it, and they have these plows which just go through it and leaving enormous banks on both sides where the snow comes down from the mountains.
Maybe there's a more cynical explanation for this, and that is there's a very expensive all-weather tunnel which has been open since 1962, and I have a feeling they like to see you use it.
Well, of course, it's about in dollars, I would say $25-$30 one way, and a little less if you go both ways, so it is rather expensive. Tunnel's about 5 kilometers. It goes under the pass, and it's a very important tunnel because it keeps the communications between Switzerland and Italy, this part of the world, open all year round.
And we have to mention that there's a major city on the Italian side as you go down from the Great St. Bernard Pass, and that is Aosta. Now, you know Aosta very well because you did research there as a student. In fact, one of your novels, it's actually, we could say, a factual novel, a political novel about the Second World War and the Italian resistance here, is based in this very area, and you know it like the back of your hand. But the Romans, I think, came here very, very early, and this was one of the important trading routes for the Romans.
What was important for the Grand San Bernard was that it linked the northwestern part of Italy with Switzerland. Therefore, the city of Aosta was really Augustus, named after a Roman emperor.
Beautiful now, ruins there. The whole city's walled in, and it's almost intact.
It's called Rome of the Alps, and it's something to see. And the route went from the Grand San Bernard through to the Lake of Geneva, and then they went by boat a little ways, and then from there they went over to Basel, which at that time was called Augst, and you can see Roman ruins at Augst. You can see Roman ruins at the city that's beneath the St. Bernard Pass on the Swiss sides. That's Martigny,
which also has substantial Roman ruins.
Yeah. Other things happened here, and it was a well-known route. And when Napoleon had to go to Italy to fight in Italy, he took his whole army with guns and everything else over the St. Bernard Pass.
Well, I'm thinking of our friend Napoleon, and he came through here, I believe, in 1802, and, well, he used a lot of facilities here for thousands of his troops. He ran up a lot of bills, which he never paid.
I guess, being general, he didn't have to pay them.
Because he said, being Napoleon, he thought he didn't have to pay them.
Later he became emperor, of course, but that was before he was emperor. But what is funny is that not many years ago, I think it was François Mitterrand, the then premier of
the late former president,
President of France, he visited one of the villages on the Swiss side, and the village mayor,
Bourg-Saint-Pierre, which is where a lot of the Napoleonic troops were put up.
The mayor of Bourg-Saint-Pierre presented Mitterrand with the bill from Napoleon's time, so Mitterrand just laughed it all off, and
they never paid up.
It still hasn't been paid.
But the one thing, I came up here for the first time, Aubrey, in 1964, and I've come up many times over the years since then. We're talking, you know, the 40 years roughly, that period, and you know what? Nothing ever changes here. The Great St. Bernard is simply eternal. You mentioned Rome before in a different context. It's as eternal as Rome. There's no building up here. There's no development. It opens, it closes, and that's it. It's déjà vu. It's like the first time I saw it. Do you agree with that?
Pretty much, except I was here 10 years before, 54, and I hitchhiked over this pass in the autumn. Very few cars, and I remember the car that took me, it was a Jaguar. He had a flat, I had to fix the flat, and the thing which was surprising was that it was paved on the Italian side, but it was all gravel on the Swiss side.
Why was that?
Because of the war, the Swiss wanted to protect their side from fascism, from the Nazis, and this was therefore really run down on the Swiss side. It was difficult to get down, and later on I biked it going down, but I had to take the bus to where the gravel ended and the paved road began. Then I could go all the way. In fact, I went that time to Geneva by bicycle. But as you say, nothing much has changed.
There's something else that we see here, Aubrey, and that is that we're in summer here now, but it gets so cold up here and so isolated that you see, it almost looks like patches of glacial ice and snow. It never melts here. And we find water trickling down everywhere, and this is, of course, a watershed area. Canton Valley is very important and very well known, especially this area, the lower valley, for hydroelectric production.
The lateral valleys that come into the Rhone Valley, feed into the Rhone Valley, most of them that can be have been dammed. In fact, coming up on the Swiss side, you see a small dam and the reservoir in the dam, which is almost full right now. Some of the large dams are enormous structures, and one, the Grand Isance, is the tallest dam in the world. If you put the Eiffel Tower in the reservoir, only the top of the Eiffel Tower would come out.
Let's take a break here, Aubrey, because we have a couple of minutes to go before we reach the hospice and monastery at the Great St. Bernard. We'll have a look in there. All right, and here we are, Aubrey, on the doorstep of the monastery. Let's go in. Aubrey, you're an historian. Is it true that the monastery and hospice has been up here on the pass since the 11th century?
Well, it has been built then, and of course it provided shelter for people who were traveling over the pass in summertime, in autumn, early snowfall, even in the spring when they tried to get over and maybe they were caught in a late snowstorm. So it provided shelter for them, and even more important, there was a presence here so that the monks could be in communication with the people down below, telling them when it was time to open up the pass and things of that sort, so that there was always the summer season that was important, because during the winter season nobody could get through here.
It must be a very lonely life. It certainly was in those days. No television, no communications. The only messages came by foot. It took a very special breed of person to spend a time up here.
Well, I guess if you're a monk, you're that kind of person.
Now, the dogs are actually from here, the Great St. Bernard breed, but you don't see them running around the streets. I understand that they are still bred on a very limited basis by one or two of the monks, but they haven't taken over, really, the village. And there is one in particular, Barry, which was the most famous St. Bernard. You'll find him stuffed in the Alpine Museum in Bern, as a matter of fact. But up here, I heard that there's a story going around, and apparently it's true, that they actually keep the bodies of people since the 19th century, the bodies of people who died through exposure, and they never found out who they were. They're kept actually preserved here, even with their original clothes on, so that if anybody has a picture of them or might be able to somehow identify them, they can come in here and pick out the victim. Before we say goodbye to the monastery and also the Great St. Bernard, there's a very important story which you know firsthand because you researched it, you wrote it up, and it's contained in your book entitled First Rains of Autumn. It has to do with the true story of a partisan or resistance operations here on the Italian side during the Second World War, and one man in particular by the name of Enrico Löwenthal.
Yes, that's right, and it's amazing. He was 18, 19, and he was in charge of the route leading up from Aosta here.
He was a partisan.
Yeah, he was partisan, and he fought. It was a very bitter struggle. He fought against the fascists and the Nazis in the High Alps, and particularly last year of the war, when Germany was losing the war, a lot of Germans went over here, and they tried to seek asylum in Switzerland until the end of the war, and he caught a whole group on the way up here, surrounded them, and told them that unless they gave him all their guns and all their rolling stock, they would be shot. But if they gave him their guns and their ammunition, they'd let them proceed over the pass. So the German soldiers, they had no choice. They didn't give them the guns and everything, and the next day they thought they were going to be shot in any case, but instead Lowenthal said to them, and he spoke perfect German because he was a German Jew whose parents had come here to live in Italy, he said, go tell your friends that a Jewish soldier saved your lives. And he became friendly with one of the officers, they exchanged addresses, and after the war was over they met again, and it continued for a long time, and he was present at the officer's daughter's birth, when she gave birth to a child in Munich.
The pointlessness of war.
Yeah, the pointlessness of war. Well, and let's say in the mountains, even though they fought one side and the other in the mountains are just such a spiritual place. It's not just a tragedy, but it's also, I think, a sin to fight one another in the mountains.
And we see all around here, right on the border, as a matter of fact, just barely on the Swiss side, stone pillboxes that were constructed by the military. This must have been extremely tense here during the war.
Well, during the war, the Italian side was fortified, the Swiss side was fortified. A lot of people escaped, not by going directly on the pass, but by being led over the border in the mountains. And there were Jews and others, soldiers, British soldiers who were interned in Italy and who escaped. A lot of these men made their way to freedom by coming to Switzerland through this area.
And tremendous history which comes alive when you visit the Great St. Bernard Pass. It's all here. It's not built up. It's barely changed for generations and generations. Aubrey Diem, professor of geography and history, writer, thank you so much for giving us your time today to look at the Great St. Bernard Pass, where you spent so much of your own time and did so much research. From the Great St. Bernard, the monastery on the Great St. Bernard, where the dogs come from, for Switzerland and Sound, this is Bob Zanotti.
You can now hear programs from PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in the App Store. It's free and just takes a few seconds. Then during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on their Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.
The term bed and breakfast will not be strange to anyone in the English-speaking world because the B&B phenomenon originally came from England, if I'm well informed, and it spread all over the world in English-speaking countries. But the bed and breakfast concept in Switzerland is relatively new. And we are talking to somebody today near the northern Swiss city of Basel, the northwestern Swiss city of Basel on the Rhine River, who knows a lot about this. It's Dorette Provost, who runs her own B&B agency called Bed and Breakfast Agency Basel. But she's also affiliated with a grouping called Bed and Breakfast Switzerland. And this is the national organization of people who are in this particular business. There's one thing we have to point out. Historically, Switzerland or Switzerland's hotels have always provided breakfast. It's included in the hotel room. But there must be other advantages. How do the advantages stack up in Switzerland as compared to the conventional hotel?
There are two advantages. One is, of course, the price, because the price in hotels is very high in Switzerland.
Especially in big city areas.
Yes, sometimes it's also a good quality you get for a good price, but some of the people do not have so much money.
And they're not all on expense accounts.
That's true. And so they need to stay in a cheaper place. And the other advantage is that you stay in a guest family, usually in a Swiss guest family, and so you can see how Swiss people live. Usually B&B is to stay in a family, sharing the bathroom, sometimes sharing the kitchen.
Of course, there's no obligation to get too close to a family. If you prefer to keep a certain amount of personal distance, that's up to you. A good host will certainly realize that and respect one's wishes. It's just a different atmosphere from a hotel, and as you say, cheaper as well. But when we use the word cheap, we're not talking about poor quality. Switzerland has a long tradition for fine hotels, and also the situation at home. People keep their homes clean and they keep them well ordered. But still, to ensure this, you must have a standard that you try to adhere to.
We have quality controls. That means that we started giving stars to our guest families, and it's not the same as in a hotel where you can have up to 5 stars. Bed and breakfast places have only up to 4 stars. For having 4 stars, you need to have a luxury place. It must be a really nice place.
Even the location has to be particularly
nice. Yes, and you need to have a private bathroom, a luxury bathroom. Mm-hmm. And for 1 star, that's a very simple place. So
almost like a hostel type of thing.
Maybe like kind of hostel. But most of our places are 3 stars.
So let's say 3 stars would be, it'd be like living in your own home, back home, more or less.
It's more or less like being private, yes.
I'm curious about breakfast. For some people who consider it their most important meal of the day, it would be nice to know what breakfast means in Switzerland. Yes. Is it the so-called continental breakfast with a croissant and coffee or tea, or is it more substantial?
No, but what we ask for is a Swiss breakfast, so that means bread and butter and marmalade. But if you want to have 3 stars, you need to serve a rich breakfast. So if you stay once in a place with 3 stars and they do not serve you a rich breakfast, then you have to call me.
Okay. Can you be a little bit more precise about the difference in price between a really nice, comfortable, let's say 3-star B&B establishment and a comparable hotel?
It depends where you stay. If you stay up in the mountains in September or July, when there is a high season, you certainly pay much more than if you would stay in a not so touristic place in Switzerland. So you have to look on our website. I think it starts at around 30 Swiss francs a night with breakfast, but it goes up to maybe 100. It depends where you are and how luxury the place is.
Just like hotels.
Bed and breakfast is not always cheap, but it's always nice and it's personal.
What about the length of stay? I mean, is there a minimum requirement of 2, 3, 4 days, or can you go to a B&B on a daily basis?
With my bed and breakfast agency in Basel, there is a minimum stay of 2 nights. But all the other places, there you can stay also 1 night.
Are reservations always necessary?
It's recommended because many places, especially the nice places, are booked very fast. So it's better to make reservation in advance.
Dorit Provost, thank you very much for telling us about the joys, the advantages, and the fun of staying in Swiss bed and breakfast establishments instead of the classic hotel. For Switzerland in Sound, from Basel, this is Bob Zanotti.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com.